Please silence all electronic devices.
I'm sorry, folks. I don't trust them, and our folks don't trust them.
There is a great deal of overreaction from those who are criticizing this legislation. They will see me in court. You know, if the General Assembly were really trying to do a power grab, there's a lot of things the General Assembly could do, and we weren't.
And they don't have a very good track record there.
Any further discussion or debate?
From the Bunker of Truth in downtown Raleigh, this is the WUNC Politics Podcast. Glad to have you along for a conversation about political maps, bipartisanship, and what in the heck else could possibly be left for our esteemed legislators to do here in 2019. I'm Jeff Tabiri, your guest today, Democratic leader of the North Carolina Senate, Dan Blue. Senator, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Jeff. Glad to be with you. Thanks for having me here.
Every quiet week somehow manages to get busy these days, these weeks. We were expecting perhaps less of a week with lawmakers not in session, but then yesterday we've got these barbs going back and forth between, and we'll just note off the top, the House side, not your chamber.
That's right.
Darren Jackson, Minority Leader, Speaker Tim Moore, what, if anything, did you glean from yesterday's latest development in the fallout from the veto override budget vote?
That there is absolutely no sense of trust between the leaders in the House and obviously between the two caucuses. Yesterday was an example of that. You resort to those kinds of tactics. It means that it's tough for the legislative process to work. Important to this is a certain sense of an ability to believe what a member tells you, whether you get along with that member, whether you've been lifelong friends or lifelong enemies. But integrity plays a great role in how this place works. And what we saw yesterday was an indication that people's integrity was being called into question. And I don't share an opinion on that one way or the other as to what the truth or the not truth of it might be. But I do know that in that kind of environment, there's very little room for legislators to be productive doing what legislators need to be doing while we're down here.
Is there a delineation between the House and the Senate when it comes to this distrust, or is it really all of one of the same?
Well, I mean, we're part of the institution, of course, and people look at the legislature as one entity. But I do think that at least there is a sense of a greater sense of camaraderie in the Senate, even though, we bitterly at odds on a lot of issues. But there's a sense of being able to rely on what somebody tells you, if somebody tells you that. And again, as I read what happened in the House, one side is saying that that they were told one thing, and the other side is saying, oh, no, we haven't been told that. Part of what we did in the Senate, Jeff, at the beginning of the session, was to impose a notice requirement on us anytime there was an effort for a veto override.
Mm-hmm.
And that has to be 24 hours. You would have to really stretch it to suspend the rules or do anything that would be a shock to members that something was being voted on if it did not comply with that 24-hour rule.
You talk about camaraderie. And I was going to ask you this later, but we're just going to go off script because sometimes you just need to go off script. You've been here for almost half your life. You've been here not to make you
Actually, I've been here more than half my life.
Have you?
Yeah, I've been here 36
years. 36
years,
and you're 70.
Yeah.
Not to,
to
out your age. But,
yeah, the arithmetic says that I've been here longer than anywhere else.
As I said to one of your staff members via email, before we conversed, I'm not good at arithmetic or math. So,
that's okay.
So I'll plead ignorance there. You've been here more than half your life. How does the level of camaraderie compare today, obviously in this climate that we're in, a not great political climate, with other stretches or segments?
There's very little comparison. But over, especially over the last probably 15 years, there are not the opportunities for members to just relax together, do fun things together. We're constantly at each other, voicing the position of our caucuses rather than letting thoughts freely flow and ideas freely flow among people across party lines and stuff. There's much greater party discipline. We've become much more like Washington, D.C. in all respects, from the standpoint of phenomenal amounts that it takes to run campaigns. You know, it's not unusual for Senate races in North Carolina, for North Carolina Senate races, to cost well north of $1 million.
And these are for seats that pay $13,000 a year.
$13,000 a year. And a lot of that fundraising is done through caucus operations. And so knowing that it's going to take a huge amount to finance a campaign, a caucus can impose tremendous discipline on you. I discourage that. But so the leadership of the caucus can pretty much dictate what the agenda is going to be and where people are going to come out on that agenda, because the races that really are competitive cost so much to run. And I mentioned a seat in Raleigh or Charlotte for both major parties could involve a race costing in the neighborhood of $3 million. I know that that's been the cost of some of the races that we've been involved in. And so from a standpoint of camaraderie, members don't socialize together as they used to, and maybe that's how things have evolved. But in a place that is predicated on compromising in order to move things down the road, you got to create an environment where you just can't demonize your opponent or somebody who's got a different idea or a different philosophy than you do. If you're going to, at the end of the day, manage to work together and share thoughts and ideas so that the best ideas win their place in the marketplace of ideas.
Tell me if I'm off on this. It sounds like in order to get a good return on your investment, and if your investment is, you know, say a Senate candidate from Wake County or Mecklenburg County, when you, not you, Dan Blue, but the collective forces that are putting in $1 million or $1.5 million to get someone elected, they don't want that person turning around and having dinner with Senator Rick Horner, who's a Republican from Rocky Mount or Nash County. Is that a fair way to synthesize it?
It is, and my question would be why. The day after the election in the Senate, we represent 190 to 200,000 people.
Each district
is about that population, and we have differing ideas and opinions within the districts as to what is the best way to run government. And the only way that you're going to settle on the best idea is to have those ideas conflicting with each other, competing for the stage, and that happens by having members of different opinions and different attitudes talking to each other, entertaining the other person's viewpoint, and having to defend their position. And if they can't defend it, it must mean it's not the right position, and you move on to one that's more appropriate, realizing that you come back again and fight another day for your strong ideas. I think that that undergirds the whole idea of this representative democracy that's in the systems and institutions of government are designed so that you get most of what you want today, but you always leave room so that you come back and negotiate again with whoever your adversary was. And you keep moving the ball down court, and that's how you progress. Different ideas, you ultimately have to compromise some of the things that you feel strongly about if you don't have a clear majority on it, but you try to move people closer to it. And in order to do that, again, it's very healthy to have conversations with people who might come from a different perspective, who might have different ideas as to what the best course to follow is. Now, if you still can't persuade them or convince them, at some point there's got to be a decision, and you decide to move on or to back off. But there ought to be the exchange of ideas and exchange of justification for those ideas so that you can really explore what the best solution to a problem is.
That sounds like an answer from a man who was first elected in 1980, not somebody who was first elected in 2012 or 2014.
But I was elected in 2012 and 2014,
you were.
And that's what I tell my constituents, that that's what we got to go at. There is no absolutes in politics based on the way the system is designed. We don't have dictators. We don't have people who have an anarchy so that they can decree what's going to be. We are a democracy. We bring the different viewpoints of all of our constituents to bear on the decisions that we make. And so we need to exchange with other legislators the best ideas that we might have and listen to the best ideas that they might have.
He is the most experienced legislator here at the North Carolina General Assembly, 13 terms in the North Carolina House, 5 in the Senate. Dan Blue, your guest on the WNC Politics Podcast. Senator, when was the last time you sat down and had dinner with a Republican, a sitting elected Republican?
You know, you're really taxing my memory. During this session, I've had dinner with a couple of Republicans. In an informal setting.
Which ones? When you say informal, just to be clear, is this a fundraiser with 200 of your closest friends?
No. Just sitting down talking to somebody.
Okay.
Trying to figure out not necessarily the fate of any particular legislation, but, you know, what are your ideas? How do you think that this ought to go and things like that? There are a couple of them that I've talked to sat down and socialized with. It wasn't always dinner, just sitting down, having a beer or something like that.
Do you care to share a name or no?
Well, I've had sat down and socialized with Senator Rabin, having a beer, having a drink or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I really haven't had intensive dinner meetings with the Republican leadership. But there are some of the others that, you know, we've been to social events together, and we will talk, and we will exchange ideas, but not to the extent that you can really frame what a policy position ought to be on an issue, because you really haven't explored fully what they're thinking about it.
Briefly, just to roll it back 20 or 30 years, and I realize there were many fewer Republicans elected to either chamber during your time here in the 80s, but were there Republicans who used to sit down and break bread with more regularly?
Routinely, probably a couple of times a week. What happened then if someone had an idea, say one of the governmental affairs people, one of the lobbyists, and they wanted to get people to consider their idea, then it was up to them to figure out how to pass it. I mean, the leadership wasn't such that they were going to pull you in and say you got to vote this way on an issue. And so there were occasions when people with competing viewpoints on something would be pulled together at a dinner, at a social event, or just a meeting to talk about, you know, how can we work through this just so that you understand where we're going. Say we were debating the gasoline tax back in the early, the mid-80s, because there was a crisis in how we were going to pave roads as the state started to grow. And on several occasions, some of those folk representing the governor would arrange for various people to go out to dinner together and talk about some of their common goals and common interest in some of the burning issues of the time. And that cut across many different industries, many different activities. And again, I used the governor. The governor's agenda is one way to do it because his lobbyists knew everybody and knew how to pull them together to make them talk about it.
And the ethics laws have changed so that now a lobbying entity cannot bring you and a couple of Republican senators to have a dinner meeting. That's against the rules. Now,
it's against the rules, but there's nothing against us initiating that kind of exchange ourselves.
Correct. One of you just has to pick up the tab. I don't mean to be flippant.
Individually, we could pick up the tab, but we can convince others to pick up their own tabs. We could do that. I mean, it's something that we could address. It just takes a determination to make it happen or a desire to make it happen. We've had those kind of conversations. I have with several Republicans, and several have mentioned it to me, but we simply have not operationalized it.
You have a pretty good relationship with Senator Berger, for at least, let me pause and say, my perception is you have a pretty good relationship with Senator Berger as we consider the relationship is falling under this bipartisan umbrella. Is there a Democrat that has a better relationship with Senator Berger?
I don't know. I mean, you would have to ask Senator Berger, what Democrat does he consider to have the best relationship with him? But, you know, I respect the office. that Senator Berger holds, and I respect Senator Berger. And we disagree very vehemently on many things. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't talk about it. We shouldn't sit down and make sure that this process works the way it's supposed to, that we shouldn't make sure that we got an environment so that members respect each other. And so respecting each other means not putting the membership through unnecessary hoops, respecting that people have families and they make plans other than being in the legislature, and they need to be able to carry through with those plans with their kids, their grandkids, their families, their spouses, and others. And so, and I think that he has pretty much abided by that same rule as he's run the Senate. Now, again, on some of the substantive issues, we have very strong disagreements. And I don't mind letting him know what our position is from a caucus standpoint, and the same with respect to him.
But in terms of the decorum, and I guess I'll call it the respect for the institution, I wonder if you think the relationship would be different if it were someone younger who was presiding over the Senate or someone who wasn't as experienced. I'll offer Speaker Moore as an example. You can take him off if you want. I'm not trying to make this a personal attack, but you mentioned fathers and grandfathers, and I think you're a little bit older than Senator Berger, but you're in a very similar place in life. How much does that help the relationship?
It helps it some, but by the same token, let me say this. Some of the younger members in the Senate, you've had Senator Heiss presiding when Senator Berger is absent. You know, I sit down and talk to Ralph, Senator Heiss, about various things, and we debate them in a sort of full-throated way. And I think that there's mutual respect there. And my position is if you really are put off by something somebody is doing, then you go to them and tell them why you're put off by it and give them an opportunity to correct it. If they don't, then you, as we used to say, then you throw down on them and let them know how much you don't appreciate it. And by the same token, some of the younger members in the House, I get along with fine across party lines. But I think that from an institutional standpoint, the leaders from each of the caucuses, from each of the party caucuses, have to respect each other first. And have to be willing to put themselves in the other person's position and understand how they would feel about various things being done to them if the role were reversed.
On Twitter, at DanBlueNC, he's the minority leader of the Democratic caucus in the North Carolina Senate. I want to ask you about the budget as well as redistricting. So let's, I guess, just march through these quickly unless you have something new and profound to tell us. The budget, of course, is still somewhat of an unsettled matter, vetoed by the governor at the end of June. Of course, this scene that played out on September 11th, it was overridden in the House, and the budget now comes before the Senate. You all have said, you, the Democrats, that you will remain united. We've heard this before, of course, on the House side. We heard this basic civics reminder here in North Carolina, 3/5 vote to override a veto. So with the numbers 29-21, Republican to Democrat in the Senate, Republicans need to convince either one Democrat to join with the Republicans or two Democrats to, as we say around here, take a walk if the chamber is it full throat. What more can you tell us about where the budget veto override saga stands at this point?
And let me say this. All I know about what happened in the House are the reports that are here. And if, in fact, the Democrats were misled into believing that there was not going to be a vote, and then there was an intentional violation of that understanding, that's unacceptable. But I don't know the facts. I did not hear any representations. But if, as described by the Democrats, that happened, then it is a real threat to the ability to govern in this place. And so they need to get it resolved, at least find out what the truth is. But let me say this with respect to the veto. All of the members in the Democratic caucus, all 21 of us, have pledged to each other and to ourselves that the governor's position on the budget is important to us, not just that we're going to do it because the governor says do it, but his position on the budget is important to us. Better teacher pay is something that's very important. Improving our schools, making sure that we're giving kids the the opportunity to develop into whatever they're capable of developing into, and giving them the resources to do that. We believe that filling this healthcare gap is important. It is inexcusable in the 21st century. I mean, a fifth of it has already gone by, that we have 500,000 people who are working. I mean, getting up every morning or every evening, going to work, putting in the hours, trying to take care of their families, that there is not health care available for them. And especially when we could make health care available for them without costing the taxpayers and citizens of this state one extra dime, because it's fully paid for in money that's already been paid into the national government by citizens of this state. And so we are very strong on the question of filling, of closing this gap, which means Medicaid expansion, which means a way to rescue rural hospitals and have decent health care in those communities as well. So we feel very strongly about these issues that the governor cites when he talks about veto, because I think it relates to job, the ability to recruit jobs and all of that. And so all 21 of us assured the governor that we're still with him. We don't plan to, as you say, at least none of those that I talked to, take a walk. They plan to be present when the veto is scheduled for a vote. But let me say again, I believe that it will be done in a way that everybody understands when the vote is, and everybody can take make the efforts to be there to vote. All 29 Republicans and all 21 Democrats. And if we have to help a few of them come, we'll do that. But I believe it will be a vote in which there's full participation by the entire Senate.
All right. 50-member vote on the North Carolina budget override of the governor's veto coming mid-October. What's that vote going to be?
There will be 21 Democrats voting to sustain the governor's veto.
Okay. And then where do we go?
Maybe we go home. But I don't know, because a lot of the pieces of the budget have already been enacted, as you might know.
Mm-hmm.
The payroll increases in multiple ways. There's a bill floating around. A lot of mini budgets. I think there have been four or five of them.
Mm-hmm.
There might be one or two others. And the ones that people feel strongly about will probably pass, and the governor probably will not veto them. And if the governor does not veto a budget, then it becomes one of these many budgets. It becomes law. If he vetoes it, I think that our members will be supportive of him, because he will articulate a compelling reason as to why he vetoes it.
Wake County Democrat Dan Blue. We're going to move to redistricting, and then I'll hit you just with some random various and sundry questions here. You've been through multiple rounds of redistricting. I would venture to guess six or seven. I mean, there's the census required redistricting, but you've also been through court ordered redistricting. You've been through a lot of these.
Well, the fact of the matter is, in every redistricting that we've had since I've been here, and I was on the redistricting committee beginning in 1981, we've had to go back and redo it. In the 80s, we went back and only had to do it once as the decisions came.
I didn't realize that. 80s, 90s, and 2000. So you had effectively two rounds of redistricting in each of those decades.
In the 80s, there were two rounds. In the 90s, there were two or three rounds.
Right, because the congressional challenge as well.
Most of these were based on the Voting Rights Act.
Right, racial gerrymandering.
Racial gerrymandering to some degree. In fact, all of them through the 2000 round of redistricting was based on gerrymandering. The state court, the Supreme Court, in the case of Stevenson, determined that we had to use whole counties when drawing legislative districts.
Yeah.
So we came up with these clusters from 2003 forward. And still, all of the redistricting battles until the one that we just came through were based on racial gerrymanders or violations of the Voting Rights Act, the 1965 Voting Rights Act, or the 14th Amendment to the 14th Amendments to the United States Constitution. This was the first one that was predicated on the state constitution regarding partisan gerrymandering.
And it is complicated and cluttered. I don't believe I've seen anywhere that you are in any way a backer of independent redistricting or independent redistricting reform or committees. It feels to me, and I'll plead.
By the way, I happen to be very much a proponent of some process that gets all of this uncertainty out of the legislative out of redistricting. But currently, the North Carolina Constitution requires that redistricting be a legislative function. So there's going to have to be a constitutional amendment, or the legislature would have to retain some power over redistricting because of the North Carolina Constitution. It says the legislature shall redistrict.
All right. Let me hammer down then. So you would like to see an independent commission. You would like to see staff here draw it, and you all get the final say. What would you like to see?
There are multiple ways that we could approach this. Some states, Iowa, lets the staff draw it, and the legislature gets one shot, and they can turn it down, but they can't change it. California has a different system. Multiple states do it different ways. We've had various suggestions on independent commissions, but before we get there, we need to know what the criteria is. We need transparency in determining what a redistricting commission or a legislature can look at. Now, the process that we went through over the last couple of weeks gives you some indication of how you could do it, and the legislature couldn't mess it up but so much, or a redistricting commission. I think that in either case, it would be something similar to what you witnessed last week.
So you would support a constitutional amendment?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. I just think it makes sense that we have a process that is because redistricting and voting is one of the most important rights that we have, the most important right that we have in a democracy. And we have to make sure that the people believe that their vote really matters, that it's not somewhere or other predetermined who's going to represent them by folk going around picking people that they want to represent rather than just randomly letting people represent folk. So that you do represent a much broader swath of the people who live in your district, and your district becomes somewhat of a microcosm of the entire state. So I'm very much in favor of some process to fix this thing. I've seen it, and the problem that we have now, gerrymandering to a slight degree was tolerated. Nobody really raised serious cases against it.
Partisan gerrymandering.
There were some cases back in the 80s of Bandemir and a few other cases that said we can't articulate a standard that governs what is real gerrymandering. But what Governor Drury did in Massachusetts 200 years ago was done basically by people looking at districts and precincts and townships, just putting them together. They didn't have the benefit of computers that can basically tell you how to sort people so that you'll know exactly what the outcome of a district is going to be pretty much for the remainder of the decade. So our technology has exceeded our commitment to democracy. And we tend to be more wedded to that technology than we are to making sure that democracy works for all people. So having a process that's transparent, having a process that takes into account what people are saying, what they're thinking, how they feel about it, is something that's absolutely critical if we're going to make people have the faith in this democracy that they ought to have.
I'm going to fire through a few
before
we get you out of here. These are quick hitters, and I will concede to you, I'll acknowledge that the first one is not a fair quick hitter, but I'm offering it to you as a quick hitter. You became the first black speaker of the North Carolina House, I believe it was 28 years ago, in 1991.
1991, yes.
28 years ago. You remain the only African-American black speaker of the North Carolina House to date.
Well, just think, 200 years went by before I came along.
Why has it been 28 years?
Since
without another minority speaker in the North Carolina House?
That's a genuine question. I don't know that it's a quick hitter.
It's not. I was trying to acknowledge that before. Yeah.
It means that we have to make sure that the process for leadership is an open process, that it truly is colorblind, and that we, as members, electing the person who might be best qualified to lead us in certain kinds of situations. I served as speaker for two terms. And really thought that we had some serious challenges facing the state, and I think that we addressed them in a very admirable way. But it wasn't me who addressed them. It was the entire body, because I thought that the entire membership of the legislature ought to be involved. And so whether you're a Republican, a Democrat, or anything else, everybody got involved with a hands-on. Jim Martin was a governor who was a Republican when I was Speaker, and Jim Hunt was a governor who was a Democrat when I was Speaker. And I worked very closely with both of them, trying to address the challenges facing the state at the time. And so that is something that occurs regardless of one's race. So we need to make sure that if there's something that members are doing that offer a roadblock to people rising through it, we've never had a woman speaker in the North Carolina House. And so we have to be sensitive to all of those things and make sure that the candidate who's best able to lead us at any given time is going to be chosen, and we don't let these artificial barriers keep us from choosing the best leadership, and we don't unnecessarily create ceilings that people can't crash through.
And while we have had women who served as lieutenant governor, or maybe just one, Bev Perdue,
I don't know
that we've had a woman as the Senate pro tem.
Never.
Didn't think so. Okay.
In neither chamber.
Earlier this year, you celebrated birthday 70. Mm-hmm. How did you celebrate?
I thought I was down here, but I wasn't. So.
That's celebration enough.
So my grandkids took me out to dinner.
Former Duke basketball player, now head coach at the University of Pittsburgh, Jeff Capel, mm-hmm. is your son-in-law.
He is.
Tell me something that the internet will not tell me about Jeff.
He's a great guy. I mean,
the internet will tell me that if you look in the right place. Yeah, if you look on like a Duke chat
board, doesn't see the exchanges and the interplay between Jeff and his three kids, my three grandkids, with my daughter Kanika. And so they don't see that, and that's a human dimension that I think is very important. But with Jeff, I mean, his kids and his family takes first place. Basketball is very important, but you can ask anybody who knows him, and they're the most important to him. He's also a, and I've been around athletes and coaches and stuff pretty much all my life. He cares deeply about his players. He doesn't see them just as somebody who he can use to build up his own reputation, but he actually cares about them being prepared to live life after basketball, that they become the best basketball players that they can, but whether they are pro players or they move on to something else after college, part of his duty is to also prepare them for life after basketball, and he takes that very seriously, spending a lot of time with them and stuff.
Do you think he's the next coach in Durham? When Coach K retires, I am told that will happen someday.
I have no idea.
I realize you're not on the hiring committee, but what do you think? Do you think he's the next coach of the Blue Devils?
Well, let me say this. I think that Coach K has produced a basketball coaching tree that is second to none. And he has a lot of players out here who played for him, who understand his system, who've been very great in what they've accomplished, whether they're pro players or whether they are coaches or anything else. And so I think that there are a lot of Duke people that the athletic director at Duke at the time that he has, she has to make that decision, can look to continue the Duke tradition of winning and making sure that the brotherhood among those players has certain values that they carry with them away from Cameron Indoor Stadium when they go out into the general world. So I feel confident that whoever the athletic director is will make the right kind of decision. And as that is made, Jeff would be as much in play as anybody else, I would imagine. Of course, the other side of it, he likes Pittsburgh very well now. He's having a ball, having success as a coach there. There comes a time when you like staying where you are rather than going somewhere else. And maybe that's why I've been here so long.
Maybe that segues into the final question quite nicely. What is the likelihood, and if you would, I guess, offer it as a percentage, that next year you are not running for a North Carolina Senate seat, but something else?
From the likelihood that I'm running for another office?
Yeah.
There is no likelihood that I'll be running for another office next year.
So that would be 0%.
Yeah, pretty much so. I mean,
pretty much so.
You'd have to go all the way to infinity to make it absolute zero.
Okay.
But the percentage is so small that you can't even assign it a numerical value. So it might be one out of a million.
So you're saying there's a chance. I'm just
No, I'm saying that I don't say absolute things unless I'm absolutely sure. But no, I have no plans of seeking any office other than the North Carolina State Senate.
Senator Dan Blue, 18-term incumbent of the North Carolina General Assembly, currently the minority leader of the Democratic caucus in the Senate. Thank you for an extended conversation.
Thank you for having me, Jeff.
Good of you, as always, to check out this week's long-form conversation. Remember, you can get a review of the week in state politics with our Friday podcast drop. We'll turn to the left and to the right with Rob Schofield and Becky Gray, respectively, on those Friday podcasts. You can subscribe to the WUNC Politics podcast feed. If you do not already, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher, feel free to leave us a rating and or a review and let us know who else it is that you would like to hear from on these forums. For Dan Blue, I'm Jeff DeBerry. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you again soon. Thank you.